Today is the 11th of March 1973 and I am Dorothy Hewitt. I started trying to write plays when I was 17 at university. Well, that's not quite true actually. I started trying to write plays when I was a very little girl and lived on a farm which was very isolated, and there were three flooded creeks, so my sister and I didn't go to school. We had correspondence lessons, and this was in the wheat belt in Western Australia. And I used to make up the plots, and we used to perform these plays, I suppose, very much in the same way as now you get people performing plays in which the actors semi-make up the lines as they go along. We did this, when was this, right back in 1930, I suppose. And sometimes I would become quite cross at my sister because she wouldn't make up the right lines, and she would have to go away and think up better ones, because I was a very dictatorial little girl, as I remember. And my grandmother lived with us, and she had been a dressmaker in Melbourne, a society dressmaker, she never ceased to tell us, and a very good one. And she had a whole sleep out full of bits and pieces of bugle beads and ostrich feathers and a silver lame and gorgeous old petticoats with masses of lace on, and all this kind, and bits of velvet, and we used to dress, and great hats, yes, great hats, and we used to dress up in these things, and we'd play all sorts of things, and we were not so much stage struck, I think, as movie struck, because my grandfather owned a movie theatre in Perth, one of the very early ones in a place called Subiaco. And he was a very dramatic sort of man who had been the 30 Bob Lair of Swanson Street, he was called, by his brother-in-laws. And he used to go down Swanson Street with no money at all and a beautiful bell topper, which I still own, and a silver-headed cane, and sort of make eyes at all the girls on Saturday mornings. And so with this sort of background and the fact that we were so isolated, and yet when we went to Perth, we were immediately plunged into going to picture show after picture show for nothing. It was a very strange sort of juxtaposition. And also we got masses of movie magazines, which used to come through the trade, you see. And these movie magazines used to be known as Dorothy's Bible. And so most of our plots were sort of very melodramatic and taken out of early movies, or adapted from early movies, or certainly influenced by movies. I love melodrama, and I love romantic themes, but I like to undercut them these days with a bit of satire, a bit of mockery, sometimes self-mockery, sometimes mockery about other things. I'd always written poetry since before I could even write. I used to get my parents up in the middle of the night to write it down, and they, poor, you know, faithful creatures, used to get up in the middle of the night in this farm where they'd been working very, very hard, and write down these words, which to this day I'm sure they wondered what on earth it was they'd spawned. But they used to do it. And I just kept on writing, very much in isolation, until I was about 15, and suddenly my father said, well, you know, I'll take you to see somebody who might be able to help you. And he took me to see John K. Ewers, who was a Perth novelist at the time. And John K. Ewers was very good. He said, I remember him saying to me, you know, whatever you're going to be, don't be a writer. Which, of course, this seemed to me quite ridiculous, because I had decided long since that if there was one thing I was going to be in this world, it was I was going to be a writer. I won a prize for English literature at school, and I got the Oxford Book of Modern Verse. And of all the things that ever happened to me, this, I think, was the most important as far as being a poet was concerned. Because don't forget that then in Australia, people were enormously isolated, particularly in the little corner of Australia I lived in. And then when I went to university at 17, I won a prize for poetry in Me Engine, and that was sort of the beginning of it all, because I began to realise that I no longer had to just write in isolation, but that I could communicate with other people, and perhaps they were interested. And I remember that this competition was held under a pseudonym, and I think the pseudonym I chose is so outrageous and so absurd that it perhaps shows what an absurd little girl I must have been. I called myself Jael Paris, J-A-E-L. God knows where I ever got it from. And they got this great heap of very esoteric, strange poetry from someone in Western Australia called Jael Paris, and everybody thought she was a very sophisticated lady of about 45, and I'd just turned 17. And now it's 1973, and I'm still writing poetry and still trying to say in poems some of the most important things I want to say. Because for me, poetry, I think, is still the most important form that I try to write in. And the style has changed, the attitudes have changed, maybe the words have changed. But I think basically I'm still that rather romantic imagist poet that I was when I was jail Paris at 17. And Australian poetry has been through some interesting innovatory periods since then. One was to the sort of wintry morning, cold, rather economical, pared-down sort of style, for instance, of a Chris Wallace Crabb, who's written a marvellous poem which says exactly this. But now it seems to be coming back to that rather romantic first morning of the world kind of feeling, which you get in poems like Bob Adamson and people like this, who are very young and who are writing again, in the style which always seems to me to be very basically Australian, and that is a romantic style with a sort of throwaway wry thing somewhere set in the heart of it. I think Australians are like this, very romantic people who hide their romanticism under what purports to be a rather tough, sardonic exterior. And I think this style will probably always be part of our literary heritage. But I then went on to go back to what was happening actually around that period to discover the poems of Judith Wright, because the moving image had just come out at that stage, and Judith Wright was one of the seminal influences on whatever I've done as a writer. She was, and I must say so. Because to see those poems, those very literate, very developed, very controlled, very passionate poems coming out of Australia then by a relatively young woman, I think she would have been 26 perhaps then, or round about that age, was an experience, because you were able to see a relatively sophisticated mind, a romantic sensibility, taking charge of the Australian environment and making of it her own special literate thing. And for those of us who were interested in this kind of development, this was a tremendous experience to see somebody doing it at last, someone we could identify with, who understood about all the problems of being an Australian and what it was like to try to write in a sophisticated way in a country that had had a literary tradition which was largely non-urban and rather, I don't want to say uneducated because that's what I mean, but a kind of folky sort of feel about it. And a kind of flatness to it all, yes, an unemotional flatness and a very masculine sort of feel to it. And here was Judith Wright writing from a woman's sensibility, and it was terribly important if you were a woman. Now, at the same time, of course, the Erin Malley scandal broke. And although we were very far removed from this, although not so far when you think between Adelaide and Perth, I can remember then that those of us who were interested in developing new frontiers in Australian writing, and I was one of them, and by this time I would have been about 18, 19, all our sympathies were with Max Harris. And all my sympathies are still with Max Harris, because I think that what he tried to do then, through his magazine and through the Erin Malley Journal, which he founded afterwards, were very brave attempts to found a much more esoteric, interesting and sophisticated culture in Australia. And that the Erin Malley affair, far from destroying Max Harris at that time, really gave him a stature in Australian life which we should all recognise now. And to us who were young undergraduates then, the Erin Malley affair crystallised something we were all feeling very strongly. Now, these poems, there's been lots written about them, and of course the writers of them said that they wrote them when they were drunk off the top of their heads. But it's very interesting to see what they did write when they were drunk off the tops of their heads, because some of the Erin Malley poems to this day, I think, are some of the most fascinating poems that have been written in Australia, and certainly at that time were far ahead of what was being written generally in poetry magazines around the country, and I think they've retained their value and their interest. And another thing, of course, was the prosecution afterwards, that absurd, mad Australian prosecution of the Erin Malley poems for obscenity and for Max Harris for obscenity for publishing them, which sort of set the whole what I call the Australian theatre of the absurd down on paper forever, because it is a hilarious reading even to this day, and some of the values that were expressed there by policemen, by prosecutors and by the people who are on trial, I think are still very relevant today. In fact, the thing I want to go on to do now, and I've been thinking about it all the week since I've been here and taking notes, I want to write a play about the Erin Malley affair, and I want to make Ern Malley a real person, and I want to make Ethel Malley a real person, and have them marching about the Australia of that time, creating mayhem as they go. I think my writing now, I'm not writing long poems anymore, actually. I haven't been. I may go back to them. I simply don't know. But at the moment, I'm much more concerned with precision and economy of expression, and capturing a certain emotional feel or moment is what's interesting me at the moment. During this last vacation, I was in Albany, which is one of the most beautiful places in Western Australia, which is not really noted for its beautiful places, being a rather flat, arid land. By the seaside, living in a tiny little house that I used to live in when I was a child on holidays, and which is now I've now inherited from my dead mother. And this little cottage, which is two rooms with the sound of the sea outside, is so nostalgic to me as to be almost unbearable. And there I was with my husband and my two little girls staying in this place for a week. And the sea, I've always been very fascinated, love the sea, love swimming in it, love everything about it, love the sound of it, love to go to bed to the sound of it outside the window. And also, I've always been fascinated by the idea of islands. I think it's got something to do with the way, and this sounds nutty, but it's the way I feel about Shakespeare's comedies, where everything comes to a beautiful circle in a charmed world like Illyria or the Forest of Arden or something like this. It all ends up with every Jack has got his Jill and the circle is complete. And I began to think about this charmed circle idea, and somehow this little house became for me like this charmed circle. It was a sort of safe enclosure for one moment against all the trials and turmoils of the outside world. And at the same time, I'd received a letter from a friend of mine, Professor Ian Turner, Professor of History in Monash University. And he had said, I'm going to the island, and this is a place where some Melbourne academics and writers go. They have this island in Bass Strait where they all go on the long vacation, which is some sort of marvellous, wild, sort of faraway place I'd love to go to but have never got to. I'm going to the island for 2 weeks in the vacation, and I'm taking my 14-year-old son with me, and perhaps there, you know, some of the all the terrible things that have happened this year will wash away somehow, and it will all be beautiful as it has always been. And I began to think of Ian on his island and me by the sea, and I wrote this poem, which is called simply The Island. And it was a very tight, I think, economical poem, which uses some, but not too, I think, esoteric references to some of Shakespeare's plays, particularly The Tempest. The Prospero Caliban sort of idea, and even the albatross out of Coleridge. And I find, someone said to me the other day, it's so strange that you who are an academic teacher so seldom use academic reference, you're not an academic poet. And I don't know whether this was sort of nagging at the back of my mind and I was thinking, right, I'll show you, bub. But I don't think it comes out like that, because when I do use literary reference, I think I try to make it relevant, or whether it works and I don't know, but I try to make it relevant to what's going on around me at the time or what I'm feeling at the time, rather than make it a cold, rather bare academic reference. I don't really like poems terribly much that are thick with reference, although one of my favourite poems is Eliot's The Wasteland, so I obviously do like it if it's done properly. And I had been teaching Eliot all the year, and this may have had something to do with it too. And so I created this rather unpublished as yet, a rather tight, economical, dream-filled, and I like the juxtaposition of being tight, economical, and dream-filled poem, which I worked over and over during the 2 weeks I was there, and I'll put it away now for a couple of months, as I always do now, in a drawer, and bring it out and see if I think it still works. And all those years when I was, you know, practicing the craft of a poet, I was being fairly regularly published in most of the well-known literary journals, Meanjin and Overland, and Poetry Australia, and Poetry, Flexmore Hudson's early poetry, which he used to get out in the 40s and 50s, and then Angus and Robertson's anthologies every year. I had quite a few poems in those, and some anthologies of poetry and prose, which I appeared in, and eventually, really took a very long time, actually. I published a collection of poems in 1968 called Windmill Country, which was printed by Edwards and Shaw and published by Overland Magazine. And this collection, much to my astonishment and everybody else's, sold out in about 12 weeks. Of course, it was a small edition, as all poetry collections, certainly 1968 were. I think they're a little larger now. But this was a rather nice thing to happen. And since then, I have almost got another collection of poems ready. I don't write a lot of poetry. I'm not prolific poet. I tend to write in bursts. I may write, four poems at the beginning of a year and not write another single one until perhaps the end of that year or the beginning of the other year. In fact, I did a little thing for myself the other day, working out in the last 6 years how many poems a year I'd managed to write, and it mostly worked out between 8 and 9 poems, which is a very small output indeed. I don't know why this is. I was much more prolific when I was young. I think I'm much more critical now, so I throw away a lot of things. And I get a lot of ideas which I never bring to fruition, partly I think because I've got a very demanding job. I work full time. There are still 3 children in our house, and there were once 5. I write plays at the same time. I write an occasional short story. I write quite a number of articles and critical stuff. I used to run, until fairly recently, an ABC program on recent books in Perth, and I often wonder if all this proliferation of activities is not a way of escaping from the fact that I don't do anything well enough. For me, one of the most difficult things is getting started on anything, because I just keep putting it off. Anything I can think of, I loathe housework, and yet I will actually look around and try to find jobs in the house to do so that I won't have to sit down and face that typewriter and that sheet of paper. And this is particularly so with any larger job, like writing a 3-act play, because I know, Slessor once said, it's a joy out of hell, writing, and I think this is so true. Once I start, I know I'm so committed to that thing that neither husband, children, friends, or anything will get me away, and I will live in this world, which is half hell, half heaven, and will not know what's going on, and will be worn out, and will be frazzled-tempered, and will be a real bitch until the whole thing's out of my system. And so the only time I really sit down to write is when it becomes too painful not to sit down and write. In other words, that you're so full of what you want to do that you can't help it. Poems are a little different because they tend to sort of well up somewhere out of your subconscious. They take hold of you, shake you about, and you wrestle like Jacob with his angel, and something comes out the other end, sometimes, you know, reasonably satisfactory, sometimes not satisfactory at all. But there for me anyway, I'm taken over completely. I have no real choice in the matter. But with writing longer things, like plays or short stories, you have a choice. You can either be committed to that at that moment or not. And my preference is usually not, but until I have to. To me, the experience of writing a play is as exciting as the experience almost of writing a poem, and these are the two things that I'm committed to. The Chapel Perilous, which still for me is the thing which I have written which is most important to me. I don't know whether it's the best thing I've written, I just know that for me it was the most important. The Chapel Perilous is, as some people have said, outrageously autobiographical, and it was never meant to be anything else. I think I'd come to the stage in my life where I wanted to really come to terms with everything that had happened to me. And I'd led a fairly tumultuous life, to say the least, what with 2 husbands and 5 children and a lover of 9 years standing and the Communist Party and disillusionment with politics and the whole thing. I suppose it was like the experience of a whole generation, but I think it was perhaps rather slightly more colourful because I always was a glutton for punishment and I could never bear to be chicken. So I wanted to somehow, for my own sake, perhaps, and this sometimes is rather dangerous because it can be very incestuous to do these sort of things for your own sake. For my own sake, I wanted to come to terms with all that had happened to me and to create a character which was me and yet was not me, which seems to me what good writing is sometimes about anyway. And so I wrote this play, which nearly killed me to write. It took me much longer than anything I'd ever written. I worked over and over it 1,000 times, particularly the second act. It nearly drove me mad. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't do anything. I was just obsessed with this play, which was like some terrible twin birth, which wouldn't be born. And I wanted to write a very free play on an open stage with scarcely any props, so that you got the whole free feeling of time and memory, because time and memory to me have always been, not just since I got older, but always, absolutely central and archetypal to the whole artistic experience. I think without a past, even an invented one, you can't exist as an artist. And I don't care if it's true, if it's real or invented. But I think I'm still very fascinated by what I would call the destruction, or what I see as the destruction of the artist in Australia, or the attempt at destruction, because I don't really think artists can ever be destroyed. But and perhaps the destruction is part of the apocalypse of the artist, and must always be so in any society, that the artist sort of rises up, you know, like the phoenix from the flames, and creates in spite of everything. And perhaps the in spite of everything is very important to the creative process. But it's these sort of characters who don't fit in, who are isolates, who stand against, or seem to stand against, all that's happening around them, that fascinate me. And these are the sort of people I think I want to create in the theatre. Eventually I did end up at university, very excited about the whole idea of going there, and immediately flung myself into theatricals, starting dramatic societies, literature clubs. I had a tremendous social life, falling desperately in love every few months with some people who have gone on to become very interesting people. And you know, finding university life so marvellous that I really didn't have time to pass exams. And of course the inevitable happened. I suddenly found myself thrown out of the university with no credentials, no nothing, because I'd simply kept on failing. And looking back on it now, feel very glad that what I did actually do in those years was to get up on the top floor of the university library and read it through in the English section. The whole lot from go to woe, just about, a very small university, but particularly the drama and particularly the poetry. After being thrown out of the university, it was a very terrible experience for me, and a love affair, which was very important to me, fell apart, and I tried to commit suicide. I recovered from that and almost immediately met a lawyer who I had known earlier on as a student, Lloyd Davies, who's now a Perth lawyer, and we were married a year before the war finished. And immediately he went away to Darwin. He was a communist, and I had joined the Communist Party at 19, as a very sort of bohemian anarchist, and had felt that I wasn't good enough to be a communist, and had left it. And now again, at the age of 22, I joined it again and went to work for a communist newspaper called The Workers' Star, which then was being published in Western Australia. And I worked on that newspaper for 5 years. And during the course of this time, I became a most dedicated revolutionary. And when I look back, there are still facets of that girl's character which I can understand, but it's almost as if I was taken over almost completely, because all the individualism that I had always prided myself on seemed to squash it down. But it kept on coming up and causing great problems later on, I think. Because I've never been... I'm what communists call an anarchist, or an individualist, which they are always very suspicious of, because I always find it very difficult to buckle down to disciplinary action, to working in a mass. I very much like to make up my own mind about things and act accordingly. And so in a way it was extraordinary discipline, but it almost destroyed me, I think, as a writer, because in 8 years I wrote hardly a word, nothing, except political journalism. Nothing else. Not even a poem, except for one. And a couple of doggerel things, which I'm very ashamed of now. Nothing else. And I know it was because the real me had disappeared under the doctrinaire. It was there, sort of simmering away, but it couldn't come out at all. And yet this thing had become so important for me, it had really taken the place of a religion.
for me, because I'd never had a religion. And to me, it was a way of shaping the world, of patterning the world, of making sense of what had seemed to me cruel, painful, and chaotic. And I was frightened to ever move out of that charmed circle of friends, comrades, people who I trusted, then trusted, didn't later, sometimes. And a marriage and a child which we had, and the whole thing was a sort of bulwarks against the world, if you like, that cruel world out there. And I used to feel incredibly deprived because this great gift which I had felt I had had gone. Therefore, what had taken its place? All this patterning of life had taken its place. Well, was it a good swap or not? I was never sure. And in my heart of hearts, I suppose, I knew it wasn't. Eventually, I met a man from Sydney, a boilermaker, a most unusual man, a very intelligent man, and I ran away with him. I ran away to Sydney, and I lived there with him for 10 years, and we had three sons, and during that time we were both communists, but he was getting more and more disaffected and influencing me in this. And I worked in such jobs as spinning mills, Butron button factories, finally finished up as an advertising copywriter for Waltons in Sydney for 2 years. He meanwhile had become more and more embittered, more closed in on himself, and schizophrenic, and at last went completely mad, and I had to leave with my three little boys, and the only place I could go back to was my parents in Perth, and that's how I returned with three children to support and went back to the university in order to get a job as a school teacher so I could support them, and because that was really, that little bit of skill I'd gained all those years ago was all I really had. Otherwise I was an unskilled labourer, and began immediately, or even a little before this, when I was working as a copywriter, to write short stories again first, which I began to get published again. And people said, oh, we thought she died. Where was she, you know, all that time? And then, coming back to Perth, somehow walking back on my own footsteps, started to write poetry again and free myself. And eventually, after the Czech affair, completely left the Communist Party. I'm not apolitical, I suppose I'm left, but left in a very individualistic sort of way, I think. I'm married again to a man who is a short story writer and a poet called Merv Lilly, who is also an ex-communist and feels about the whole experience, I think, much as I do. We have two more little girls. I work as a senior tutor and occasionally lecturing at the university. We have a good life, I think. Together, I think we make a pretty good combination. People often accuse me of being cynical and despairing and melancholy, particularly in the plays that I write. And I suppose at times I'm all these things, but I do believe in living, and I believe above all things in the relationship between men and women, and I believe in love. Love between men and women, love between men and men, love between women and women, love between children and children, children and grown-ups. I know this is a terribly banal thing to say. I'm quite aware of it. But to me, there just isn't any substitute for treating people like individuals who all have some sort of tremendous vitality in themselves. And if they haven't, then it's terribly sad and they're sort of imprisoned people. And therefore, one of the things I love about the theatre is mixing with people, because writing is a very lonely occupation, and it has to be quite a lot of the time. But the theatre is like that marvellous circle I was talking about earlier on in Shakespeare's comedies, where everything comes to its appointed end in this beautiful pattern, which I think all my life I've been looking for, and have somehow found it in the image of a theatre where one can make people three-dimensional, actually moving on stage, and where those people, those actors, that director, can also be part of this whole giving, learning, creating process, which to me is the meaning of life. Women, I think, have... Women artists, it's particularly difficult for them, and yet particularly rewarding, because they have two creative things. They have the creative thing of giving birth physically to children if they want to, and the creative thing of giving birth to works of art. Now, this can be a struggle, because one side of their nature may fight against the other, and it makes life very difficult, because artists need isolation, they need peace, they need time to be alone, and all the rest of it. But this, I think, when women can overcome some of the disadvantages of being women, they know a lot about the creative process organically anyway. And therefore, to live creatively altogether as one thing, not as a separate esoteric intellectual exercise, but to live creatively through the earth, through their whole bodies, and creatively through their heads too, it seems to me what women as artists are all about, and this is what they've got to give to the world. And as a woman and as an artist, I seem to me to have come a very long way, and I think there's not much time left, and I'm frightened of that, and I feel like saying with Keats, give me 10 years, and he never got it. And therefore I feel this terrible sense of urgency that I've got all this great world in my head and I must get it down on paper. Well, why do I want to? Do I think that what I've got to say is so unique and so marvellous that I've got to have the time? Yes, that's part of it. I do think that, and this is the ego thing. But also, I don't want to go out like a puff of nothing. I don't want to just die like a piece of dust. This is a sort of immortality, and the only one I really think is worth having in the end, to have something live after you. And what I want to have live after me is not just 5 children, and I've now got 2 grandchildren, not just that, but words, because words to me have always been the magic thing and will never stop being like that.